So in our discussion of the case for classical Christian education, we come to chapter 11, The Christian Heart and Mind, and this is a discussion of the Christian worldview. Okay, so what is a Christian worldview? As I say in the first on the first page of that chapter, to answer the question, we have to begin with what it is not. And in some of the subtle cases, we have to consider what a Christian worldview almost is. In the first place, a Christian worldview is not the same thing as a Christian worldview jargon. The oldest trick in the world is to attach oneself to some promising movement or other by simply putting on the uniform and leaving the gun at home. Talking imitatively without understanding is not all that difficult. So a Christian worldview is not saying what you were already thinking with a Bible verse attached, or saying what most conservative Christians would say about business or economics or politics with some verse dragged in from the side. In order to be a true Christian worldview, Scripture has to operate as a true functional authority, which means that when we run into something in the Word that conflicts with what we teach or say or assume, we change. We don't change the Bible to suit our views. We change our views to fit with the Scriptures. I go on. Secondly, and this is crucial, a Christian worldview is not a condiment added to a plate full of neutral food in order to flavor it. The faith of our fathers is not an educational afterthought. The potatoes always come from somebody's kitchen. Sometimes Hindus, Muslims, and atheists can be induced to eat Christian potatoes because the Christian education provided at the school is outstanding, but far more common is the practice of Christians eating unbelieving agnostic potatoes with lots of gravy slathered on to cover the smell. So there is no neutrality. There is no such thing as a neutral fact. There's no such thing as a raw fact. That means that the most pedestrian of truths learned in a school, such as Columbus discovered America in 1492, or 2 plus 2 equals 4, or oranges are round, or oranges are orange. If you take those truths and say, well, someone might want to say, surely those things are true whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. Surely 2 added to 2 equals 4 is true whether or not Christianity or Hinduism is the case. Well, not exactly. How can 2 plus 2 equal 4 if all is 1? Right. If everything is 1, if there's no such thing as 2, if an enlightened person sees the unity of all things, then 2 plus 2 is Maya, it's illusion. So a third point I make is that a Christian worldview does not somehow automatically sanitize the world so that we can all go watch any R-rated movie that we want now for any reason we want because we have a Christian worldview. Put bluntly, a Christian worldview is not an excuse for compromised sinning. A Christian worldview is not an all-purpose disinfectant. So that's what a Christian worldview is not. A Christian worldview is not it is not attaching yourself to some promising movement. It is not going along with the pretense of neutrality. And it's not an all-purpose sanctifier where you can ingest all kinds of crud because you know about worldview thinking. So, stated positively, what is a Christian worldview? It means being an obedient Christian in all of life. In Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9, which is a passage that addresses parents teaching their children to walk in the law of God and to love it. Well, that's the passage where the greatest commandment, according to Jesus, in all of Scripture is given. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And it's worth noting that is a commandment that is found in a passage on education. So when the Bible is talking to parents about how to teach their children, in the course of that discussion, we find the greatest commandment in all of Scripture. And that means that education is not an add-on extra. Education is where we're teaching our children to grow up into their highest vocation, which is to be lovers of God. So, a Christian worldview means living an obedient Christian life in everything that you do. It's not a set of propositions only. It's not just what we think. It includes what we think. It includes propositions, true propositions. Jesus rose from the dead is a true proposition. Jesus died for the sins of his people. It's a true proposition, and you can't take those out and still have a Christian worldview. But you could cluster a bunch of true propositions together and not yet have a Christian worldview. More is involved in that. So the scriptures speak, this is something I say in that chapter, the scriptures speak of God as the one who tries the heart and reins of men. The reins there would be the kidneys. Our metaphor for this would be God testing the head and the heart, the reason and the emotions. But in the ancient Hebrew metaphor, the heart was the seat of the intellect, and the reins, the kidneys, were the seat of the affections. So while Scripture does distinguish reason and emotion, it does not separate them the way that we tend to do. They are both located in what C.S. Lewis, in his great book on education, entitled The Abolition of Man, called The Chest. Our thoughts do not float on the surface of our lives like leaves that fall in the pond. Our thoughts are not just incidental to us. Our beliefs, our commitments, the propositions that we hold dear are in the gut. They're in the chest. They are at the core of a man. So, unless, as I say further in the chapter, unless faithful worship of the living God is at the center of our lives and our communities, and therefore at the center of all our children's education, Christian worldview education will simply be one more hollow intellectualist experiment. You're just teaching kids who don't live as though the Bible is the supreme authority in their lives to parrot back certain phrases when asked. And that's catechetical instruction at its worst. Now, I've got nothing against catechesis, but I do have something against mere catechesis. If you train the children to simply respond, what is the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. And all you did when you asked that question was to put the nickel in, and you got the stated response out without any reflection or thought or commitment or investment, then it's no good. Some wit once defined education as a process whereby the notes of a teacher wind up the contents of the notebook of a teacher wind up as contents of the notebook of the student without passing through the mind of either. So if you have just an information download, if it's just a data dump, and you say, here's what I think, here's what they pay me to stand up in front of this class and say, and this is what somebody is encouraging you to write down into your notebook until you get to the point where you graduate and you're all done, that's not really education. Education has to engage the student and make the student think, make the student dig into what's actually being said. So God is not a larger version of us, only bigger and smarter. The Christian faith does not point to God as a Homeric deity like Zeus, an overgrown celebrity. It is not the case that God is sort of in the ocean of being together with us, only he's the whale and we're the minnow or the krill. That's not our relationship to him. He's the transcendent God, and he exists independently of the creation. And so consequently, we can walk in him, love him. In him we live and move and have our being, as we're talking about everything. So that whether it's history or math or whatever it is we're doing, God suffuses that subject, but is not identified with the subject. He's outside the created order, which is why there is such a thing as fixed objective truth. So, in order to grasp this, I need to throw in one other essential component in Christian worldview thinking, and that is that not only are we created by God, He is the transcendent God who spoke the world into being, and so we relate to Him as creature to creator. That's one reality. But the other reality is that in the first chapters of Genesis, by the time we get through chapter 3, we have already read about the fall of man. So in Genesis 1 and 2, we've read about the creation of man. We see man and woman together as creatures in Genesis 1 and 2. And then by the conclusion of chapter 3, we see man and woman as sinners. Now, because of the reality of sin, we have what theologians call the fall, which means that everything went haywire. Everything went off at that point. And in Genesis 3, God establishes antipathy between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. And so consequently, there are two divisions that we have to keep in mind as we pursue the process of education. These are two fundamental divisions. The first one is between creator and creature. What is the divide between creator and creature? And then the second, and that's an ontological division between God, the uncreated creator, and man, the contingent being whose existence is dependent upon the will of another. That's an ontological divide. The second divide is an ethical divide. And that's the division between obedience and disobedience, faith and unbelief. And that divide is called the antithesis. Down through all of human history, we've had believers and unbelievers, beginning with the first manifestation of it. It began before this, but the first overt manifestation of this was the conflict between Cain and Abel. So in 1 John, we're told that unbelievers are of the lineage of Cain, and Jesus refers to righteous Abel, whose blood cries out for vengeance. So Abel was righteous, and Cain was unrighteous. And Abel is sort of a pattern or an example for believers to follow. Cain is a pattern or example that unbelievers do, in fact, follow. So, this antithesis that's established in Genesis 3 runs through all of human history, and you can't educate unless you're making ongoing reference to this antithesis. I say this in this chapter. So, the antithesis is a given, but because it is, some will always try to misplace the antithesis. In other words, they affirm it in principle, but misapply it in practice. Misplacing it is really the first of two basic ways to try to get away from this antithesis between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, between faith and unbelief, between covenant-keeping and covenant-breakers. People misplace the antithesis by affirming the fundamental divide between good and evil, but then misdrawing the lines of that divide. The lines are thought to be tribal or racial or political. Misplacing the antithesis is the besetting sin of secular conservatives. So a nationalist will say the antithesis is between the USA and all those other second-rate countries. He's claiming there's a fundamental divide, but he says it's between my nation and your nation. Or a white supremacist will say the antithesis is between the white race and all the others. That's where the person affirms the antithesis, but draws the line in the wrong place. The line is actually to be drawn between faith and unbelief, faith in God through Christ or not. That's the only fundamental, true, final antithesis. The liberals or the progressives mess up the antithesis in a different way. I say this, but the liberal method is to deny that there is an antithesis. We are all saying the same thing, really. Come on, people, now smile on your brother, etc. This tendency is very popular these days, and it explains the common treatment of Christians. If there is no antithesis in the world, then the one intolerable thing is to insist that there is. The default divide therefore comes between one group that says there is no antithesis and the wicked others who maintain that there is. Two groups. One says that it is true that there is no truth, and the other group says that that's not true. So if you say, and of course, if someone's over on the other side of that line saying there is too an antithesis and you're saying there is not one, then regardless of the other guy's arguments, his very existence is an embarrassment to your position. You've got to shut him up. You've got to say that he's mentally ill, or you got to put him on a train to the Sunny Farms re-education happy camp, where he will be taught to think more reasonably. And this is one of the reasons why progressives have such a hard time with saying, yes, you're a reasonable, sane, thoughtful individual, and you are disagreeing with me about these fundamental issues. They can't do that because their whole project depends on denying that there is, in fact, an antithesis. One concluding thought on this. Every Christian school must adopt an implicit, absolute, childlike wonder at the glory of the Scriptures. We must be people of the book, knowing it from top to bottom, front to back. And we must resolve before the fact to have absolutely no problem with any passage of Scripture once the meaning of that passage has been ascertained through honest exegesis. This means, among other things, that Christians must be prepared to condemn sodomy, embrace the doctrine of creation, say that husbands are the heads of their wives, believe in giants and dragons, and believe in Noah's Ark, right down to, if necessary, the giraffe's head sticking out of the window.
I'm a 2009 graduate of New St. Andrews College, and I'm a commercial property manager.
Three kids at Logos, one at home still, and I do flowers on the side out of our house. When you have these little people that you're responsible to shepherd, you realize I need to know what I'm talking about because they need to have a firm foundation and they need deep roots so that they don't get blown over and that they're ready to stand up for the truth.
I am a programmer. The language aspect of NSA is a fantastic preparation for any sort of programming.
I'm a real estate broker here in town. I think absolutely the perfect education for being in sales of really any kind.
I actually put it to a lot of great use when I was working in the political realm.
I am a pastor in Central Coast, California. Whatever vocation you take, it'll make you take that seriously because you're seeing it through the lens of the sovereignty and lordship of Christ.
For more information, visit us online at nsa.edu.